crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. On May 13th, 2026, the South Carolina Supreme Court did something pretty rare. In a unanimous decision, 5 justices, 0 dissents, it threw out the double murder conviction of Alec Murdoch and ordered a new trial. Now, for a lot of people, that name won't be new. If you've been anywhere near the true crime space in the last few years, you've heard it. There was a Netflix docuseries, a Hulu miniseries with Patricia Arquette. There were podcasts and books, and there was wall-to-wall coverage of a 6-week trial in early 2023 that ended with a jury convicting Alec of killing his own wife and son. Now, believe it or not, I'm not one of the people who followed the trial. I get asked a lot what true crime stuff I consume in my off time, and my answer is, I don't. I cover crime for a living. I don't come home saying, yeah, let's find some more crime to hear about. And as you know, I prefer covering older cases. When I was a daily reporter, which I was for some 30 years, I hated having to do what's called the quarter turn coverage. As in, every quarter turn of the screw, you'd have to write a new story. I mean, it might be important to the case, don't get me wrong, but it can feel overwhelming for the reporters, not to mention the people involved. And now that I'm not doing daily coverage, I can say from that side of things, it can be overwhelming for the reader, too. In short, I knew so little about this case before writing this episode that I didn't realize Alec Murdoch's name was pronounced Alec instead of how it's spelled, A-L-E-X, until I was researching it, which brings us here. This is, of course, not a standard Crimes of the Centuries episode. It's a bonus episode under the heading Future Crimes of the Centuries. Did you hear the question mark? I've started doing these now and then to offer a synopsis of cases that have been all over the news, so much so that I figure some people might be getting too overwhelmed by the drip, drip, drip to figure out what the hell is going on. So I've read up. I've read available court documents, I've watched available trial testimony, and I'm going to lay out the parts of this case that stand out to me, particularly the aspects that feel a bit undercovered beneath all the nonstop attention. Now, you might be asking, do we need another look at the Murdoch case? Yeah, maybe not. But you, dear listener, aren't losing a regular episode for this detour. This is just a bonus done for those people who care to have the case presented in a way they haven't heard before. It's okay to skip. I won't be offended. Now, the reason this case caught my attention now is because the conviction was just thrown out. And I do a lot of reporting on wrongful convictions in my other life as reporter and host of the podcast, What If They're Wrong After the Accusation? Before that, I was the reporter behind the investigative podcast Accused, where we help get a guy on death row cleared of all charges. When convictions are set aside, I pay attention. This one is unique, though, because the reason the conviction was thrown out isn't because new evidence emerged pointing to someone else. It's not because prosecutors relied on junk science or bad forensics or that a witness recanted. The conviction was thrown out because the clerk of court, an elected official named Rebecca Becky Hill, whose job was literally to manage the jury and ensure the fairness of the proceedings, allegedly told jurors not to trust Alec's testimony before he even took the stand. She wrote a book about the trial just months after the thing ended, which is really unusual. She showed sealed court exhibits to a media member and lied about it under oath. And my read on all of this is that maybe Becky Hill had spent her entire life watching the Murdoch family operate in South Carolina's Lowcountry, where they had wielded enormous legal and political influence for more than a century. She seems to have become so convinced that Alec Murdoch was going to get away with murder that she couldn't bring herself to trust the system to work on its own. So she broke it. The Supreme Court also addressed a second problem with the original trial, one that will shape whatever comes next. Prosecutors at the trial spent 12 and a half hours presenting evidence of Ellick's financial crimes. We're talking client theft, fraud, years of stealing, as proof of motive. The court agreed that some financial crimes evidence was appropriate to establish that motive, but it found that the state went, in the court's words, quote, far too long and far too deep into details that have nothing to do with why he might have killed his family. In short, they said it was all more prejudicial than probative. The justices argued it was presented to make Ellick seem like a bad guy. And while it did its job, the justices argued it wasn't tied directly to the murders enough to justify such detailed inclusion. That's what this episode is about. Not the murders, or not only the murders. It's about the world that produced all of this. A world where a woman with a front row seat to history decided that justice needed her personal assistance to function. A world where a housekeeper who worked for a powerful family for 25 years died under questionable circumstances and nobody looked twice. A world where a 19-year-old was found dead in the middle of the road and investigators on the scene said plainly it looked like a murder, yet somehow it stayed a hit and run for years. And a world where all of this didn't come to light until a powerful man from an even more powerful family was accused of killing his wife and son.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Most coverage of this case seems to begin with the deaths of Maggie and Paul Murdoch, which is fair. Those are the deaths that thrust this case into the spotlight and led to Ellick Murdoch's disastrous fall from grace. But I'm going to start with a woman named Gloria Satterfield. Gloria was born in February 1961 as Gloria Harriet. She was the oldest of eight children. She attended Wade Hampton High School and was still relatively young when she gave birth to her first son, Brian, in 1985. Brian had her maiden name and also had special needs. Not long after, she married David Michael Satterfield, an Army veteran, and had a second son named Tony in 1989. In the mid to late 1990s, Gloria went to work for a family in Hampton County, South Carolina, a prominent family headed by an attorney named Ellick Murdoch and his wife Maggie, who had their own two boys. Gloria worked as the family's housekeeper and, for a long stretch of those years, essentially a nanny. She helped raise those sons. Richard Alexander Murdoch Jr. was named after his father, who went by a shortened version of his middle name. The younger Richard Alexander went by Buster, which was also a nickname of Ellick's grandfather. You'll see there's a lot of tradition tied to the Murdoch family. Anyway, Gloria was part of the fabric of the Ellick-helmed household for more than two decades. By the time things went wrong, she'd been widowed by then. Her husband died in 2013. On February 2, 2018, 57-year-old Gloria Satterfield fell at the Murdoch family's hunting estate, a sprawling 1,700-acre property in Calton County called Moselle. The details of exactly how she fell were, from the beginning, pretty murky. According to Ellick, the family's dogs caused the fall. Maggie called 911 that morning and told the dispatcher that Gloria had fallen going up 8 brick steps outside the home and that her head was bleeding. When a male voice, apparently Alec, joined the call, he said he believed she had hit her head and possibly had a concussion. Gloria was airlifted to a hospital. It must have been quite a fall because she lingered there for more than 3 weeks before finally succumbing to her injuries on February 26, 2018. Now, despite this being an unnatural death, no autopsy was performed. Her death wasn't reported to the Hampton County coroner at the time it occurred. Even more strangely, on her death certificate, the manner of death was listed as natural causes. This is the Satterfield's lawyer, Ronnie Richter, talking to 48 Hours.
There's nothing natural about a 57-year-old woman falling down a flight of steps and dying from head trauma.
At the time, though, that didn't seem to raise any red flags. No investigation was open, no one asked questions. In Hampton County, South Carolina, the Murdoch family had been the law, quite literally, for nearly a century, as we'll talk about in a minute. So apparently, a housekeeper could fall down the steps and die at one of their homes, and nobody needed to look into it. But the story didn't end there. After Gloria died, at the funeral, in fact, Alec Murdoch approached her sons, Tony and Brian, with what he framed as a generous offer. He told them that they should sue him. That might sound odd, but Alec was a lawyer, and he said basically, "Hey, that's what my home insurance is for. Your mom died on my property, and it was my dog's fault. I want to make sure you're taken care of." So he said to file a wrongful death claim against him so they could collect from his homeowner's insurance policy. It seemed like the magnanimous gesture of a man who considered them extended family. He was going to make sure they were taken care of. So when he suggested an attorney he knew to handle the case, they accepted the offer. That attorney happened to be Alex's college roommate and close friend, a guy named Corey Fleming. Now, Tony and Brian had no reason to think there was anything wrong with that arrangement. Alec Murdoch was a prominent attorney. He had been their mother's employer for most of their lives. He was offering to help.
A lot of trust was placed in both Alec and in Corey to do the right things. And it really went south from the outset.
As far as the Satterfield sons were concerned, the insurance claim didn't go anywhere. They filed the suit and then heard nothing about it again. Here's what they didn't know. Behind their backs, Fleming successfully negotiated settlements with Alec's insurance carriers totaling $4.3 million, a huge sum of money for two guys, one of whom was special needs, whose parents were both dead by then. A South Carolina judge approved the settlement arrangement, and then Fleming asked the approving judge not to file the settlement paperwork with the county clerk of court. The settlement was approved in secret, kept off the public record. Tony and Brian Satterfield never received a single dollar of that money. And they needed that money. After his mother's death, Brian lost his mobile home to the bank and had to go live with relatives, according to the family's attorney, Eric Bland. Alec had to have known this because he kept in regular contact with the brothers, as Tony told People magazine. Tony said that Alec, quote, "every now and then would reach out to see how we were doing," end quote. By doing that, he maintained the appearance of concern. Meanwhile, Alec funneled the funds through fake bank accounts he had set up under a name designed to look like a legitimate structured settlement processing company, the kind of firm that routinely handles large payouts for personal injury cases. The name looked normal on bank statements. Nobody at his law firm questioned it. The money simply disappeared into Alec's personal finances. He later admitted he fabricated the dog story entirely. The dogs didn't cause Gloria's fall. He invented that account to manufacture liability and trigger the insurance payout. He used the circumstances of his housekeeper's death as a prop in an insurance fraud scheme. And then he stole the money that was supposed to go to her children. Now, none of this came to light for more than 3 years. It was only when Alec was arrested in connection with the murders of his wife and son in 2021 and investigators started pulling on threads that the Satterfield fraud unraveled. The Hampton County coroner, a woman named Angela Topper, was the one who finally flagged the inconsistencies in Gloria's death. She wrote to the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, noting that the death had not been reported to her office at the time it happened, and no autopsy had been performed, and that the manner of death, as natural causes, was inconsistent with someone dying from injuries sustained in a fall. She requested an investigation. SLED opened one in September 2021. Gloria's death remains, as of now, officially unsolved. We don't know whether she was simply the victim of an accident that Ellick then exploited, or whether something more deliberate happened at Moselle that February morning. What we know is that for more than 3 years, the question was never even asked. Tony and Brian Satterfield eventually recovered money through settlements with other parties in the lawsuit, Fleming's former law firm, the bank involved in the fraud. Ellick confessed to a judgment of $4.3 million, a formal legal admission that he owed them that amount, but by the time he did that, he was a man serving life in prison with no meaningful assets, so collecting that money is an uphill battle. So to recap, Gloria Satterfield worked for the Murdoch family and died in their home. Her employer fabricated the story of her death, stole the money meant for her children, and the whole thing sat undisturbed for years because in Hampton County, South Carolina, the Murdoch family was the law. And we'll talk about what that actually meant after this break.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
To understand the Murdoch family's hold on Hampton County, you have to go all the way back to 1910. That's when Randolph Murdoch Sr. opened a small law office in Hampton, South Carolina. 10 years later, in 1920, he was elected solicitor for the state's 14th Judicial Circuit, the equivalent of district attorney, the top prosecutor for a 5-county region of the South Carolina Lowcountry. He held that office until his death in 1940, when he was struck by a train near the Early Branch community in Hampton County. His son, Randolph Buster Murdoch Jr., was elected to replace him that same year. Buster held the solicitor's office until 1986. His son, Randolph Murdoch III, that's Ellick's father, took over and held it until 2006. So three consecutive generations of the same family controlled prosecution in the same 5-county region for 86 years. That's why the locals call the district Murdoch Country. It wasn't a casual nickname. It was an acknowledgement of something structural. Now, the Murdoch family wasn't just in charge of the area's prosecutions. They also simultaneously ran the biggest plaintiff's personal injury firm in the region. The conflicts of interest baked into that arrangement over nearly a century are almost impossible to fully untangle. The law firm itself, it's called Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Eltzroth, and Detrick, which is a mouthful, built much of its success through a South Carolina statute that allowed plaintiffs to file civil suits in any county where an out-of-state company owned property, regardless of where the underlying accident occurred. Hampton County judges, operating in a courthouse where the Murdoch name carried enormous weight, generally declined to transfer cases. Plaintiffs' attorneys from across the state knew to file in Hampton County if they wanted favorable conditions. The Murdochs had, in effect, engineered a forum that worked in their favor, and then they worked that forum for decades. Alec Murdoch was the fourth generation. Unlike his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, he wasn't named Randolph, and he didn't run for solicitor. He became a partner at the law firm instead, specializing in personal injury litigation. On paper, he was a wealthy, prominent attorney with a beautiful family and a 1,700-acre hunting estate. Underneath that, he was a functioning opioid addict who had been stealing from his clients and his own law firm for years. This part isn't disputed, and it's not undercut by the recent overturning of his murder conviction. And when the financial fraud finally came to light, it was staggering in its scope and its callousness. And we're not just talking about stealing from the Satterfield heirs. Alec stole from a man who had become quadriplegic after a crash. He stole from a trust fund set up for children whose parents had been killed in a wreck. He stole from his own law firm's operating accounts. Estimates of the total amount he stole range upward of $12 million over more than a decade. He ran the money through fake accounts, he forged signatures, and he manipulated vulnerable clients who trusted him because of his family name and his position in the community. That name was the key to all of it. In Murdoch country, the name opened doors and closed investigations. It meant that when Gloria Satterfield died without an autopsy, nobody asked why. And it meant that when a 19-year-old named Stephen Smith was found dead in the road in 2015, the case was handled, or not handled, in ways that still don't fully make sense. Stephen Smith was born January 29, 1996, in Lexington County, South Carolina. He had a twin sister named Stephanie, two other sisters, and two brothers. He, like Gloria, some 15 years before he was born, had graduated from Wade Hampton High School in 2014, after which he enrolled at Orangeburg Calhoun Technical College. People who knew him described him as someone who wanted to make something of himself, a guy who loved school, loved his family, and was inseparable from his twin. He was openly gay in the low country of South Carolina, in a small rural community where everybody knew everybody. That probably required a certain kind of courage. On the morning of July 8, 2015, a driver passing along Sandy Run Road in Hampton County found Stephen's body in the middle of the road. His death was quickly ruled a hit and run. But that ruling came despite what investigators on the scene had reported seeing. Corporal Michael Duncan, in his audio notes from the scene, recorded that there was no body trauma other than to the head area, which, in his opinion, was not consistent with being struck by a vehicle. Investigator Todd Proctor was more direct. He said, quote, "Typically, you don't see the highway patrol working a murder, and that's what this is," end quote. He also said, quote, "There's a reason why Hampton County Sheriff's Department is not handling this, and I'll leave it at that," end quote. Here's a recording of Trooper David Rao in a clip from a 48 Hours documentary.
"Nothing at the scene appeared that it was a vehicular accident. Walked both shoulders of the highway, east and west, looking for any evidence. Didn't see anything that appeared to be vehicular involved."
Usually you see something, bits of glass from a car, tire marks from slamming on the brakes, something. Troopers saw nothing of the sort, and the injuries to Stephen didn't quite line up. Here's Stephen's mother, Sandy Smith.
"The only damage to his body was his head, from his right eye socket to the back of his head. His right shoulder was dislocated."
If someone's hit by a car, they don't tend to just have isolated injuries on their upper bodies. Usually the bumper hits them at the knees or the thighs. The body might be dragged along the road, leaving road rash. Stephen had none of that. Despite the early doubts, the hit-and-run ruling stood. But something else was happening in Hampton County at the same time. Almost immediately after Stephen's death, a name started circulating.
"The only name that was given to me was the Murdoch name, and of course everybody's kind of shy to say that out, you know what I mean?"
According to the Hampton County Guardian's managing editor, who was covering the story, rumors were spreading that Buster Murdoch, Alec's oldest son and a former classmate of Stephen's, had been in a vehicle with other young men the night Stephen died, and that someone in the vehicle had struck and killed Stephen. The Murdoch name appears dozens of times in the original case file obtained by CBS News' 48 Hours through public records requests. Investigators noted that they had attempted to contact Buster Murdoch, but there is no record in the file of any investigator actually speaking with him. To be clear, Buster has denied involvement and has never been charged. There's no public evidence tying anyone in the Murdoch family to Stephen's death. Even the Smith family lawyer told 48 Hours that the suspects they have in mind are not connected to the Murdochs. Regardless, the case sat cold for almost 6 years. Then, in June 2021, Maggie and Paul Murdoch were murdered at Moselle. SLED began investigating the double homicide, and somewhere in the course of that investigation, they found something that led them back to Stephen Smith. In June 2021, 2 weeks after the murders, SLED released a brief statement saying it was opening an investigation into Stephen's death based on information gathered during the Murdoch murder investigation. SLED eventually reclassified Stephen's death as a homicide, not as a hit and run. As of today, no one has been charged. His mother is still waiting. There is a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. Whatever SLED found in the Murdoch murder investigation that led them back to that road in Hampton County remains undisclosed. Stephen Smith wanted to be a nurse. That's what he was studying for. He had a twin sister who has said she misses hearing him yell at her when she gets on his nerves. His mother has spent more than a decade now fighting to have his death treated as what investigators at the scene said it plainly was. And when we come back, we'll talk about the murders that broke all of this wide open. Though, before that, we have to talk about yet another death first.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
By early 2019, two deaths that are now viewed through a decidedly suspicious lens were tied to the Murdoch family, though only one of them, Stephen Smith, had been part of any investigation at that point. That was about to change. In February 2019, Alec's younger son, 19-year-old Paul, was out with a group of friends spending an evening in Beaufort County, drinking and boating. At around 2 in the morning on February 24th, the boat struck a piling on the Archer's Creek Bridge near Paris Island. Mallory Beach, 19, a recent high school graduate who wanted to become an interior designer, was thrown into the water. The other passengers were taken to a hospital. Despite a search, Mallory wasn't found for 8 days. Her body was recovered about 5 miles downstream. An autopsy found she had suffered blunt force trauma in the crash and then had drowned. The night of the wreck, Mallory's boyfriend, Anthony Cook, was devastated. You can hear him here, screaming at Paul.
Bro, you smiling like it's funny.
Sit down.
My girlfriend gone, bro.
Sit down.
You think it's funny?
Straight away, he worried about how the investigation into Mallory's death would be handled. Here he is, talking to police.
You all know Alec Murdoch?
Oh, yeah, I know his name.
That's his son.
That's so driving the boat.
Good luck.
Alec Murdoch showed up at the hospital that night. Nurses there later told investigators that Alec appeared to be working the room, approaching the injured teenagers individually, seemingly trying to get them to say that someone other than Paul had been driving the boat. One nurse reportedly instructed Alec to stay in Paul's room and let investigators do their job. And they did. Paul's blood alcohol level was later determined to be more than 3 times the legal limit. About 2 months after the wreck, Paul was charged with 3 felony counts of boating under the influence, including causing Mallory's death. Those charges, it's worth noting, came down on what would have been Mallory's 20th birthday. By that time, Mallory Beach's family had already filed a civil lawsuit. Their attorney, a man named Mark Tinsley, wanted a full accounting of Alec Murdoch's finances as part of the litigation. Here's Tinsley later testifying about being approached by Alec about the suit at a fundraising event.
But the room's full of lawyers, and Alec sees me, and he comes across, and he gets up close in my face and says, "Hey, Bo, what's this I'm hearing about what you're saying? I thought we were friends." And I replied, "Alec, we are friends. If you don't think I can burn your house down and that I'm not doing everything and I'm not going to do everything, you're wrong. You need to settle this case." The point of it was, we're friends. I took it as he tried to intimidate me. He didn't intimidate me and sort of bully me into backing off.
This looks even worse in hindsight when you know that the financial disclosure Tinsley requested would have exposed the millions Alec had been stealing from clients for years. A hearing on those financial records was scheduled for June 10, 2021. On June 7th, 3 days before that hearing, Alec Murdoch called 911 and reported that he had come home to find his wife Maggie and son Paul shot dead at the dog kennels on the Moselle property. Now, that 911 call has been played ad nauseum, so I won't add it here. There's a lot about this case that you can look up other places if you're so inclined. Maggie Murdoch was 52 years old. She had been with Alec for decades, through his addiction, through the pressures of the family name, through years of a marriage that, by some accounts, she was loyal to long after it would have broken most people. Paul was 22 and living under the cloud of felony charges from the boat crash, a young man whose trajectory had already been bent hard by the family he was born into. By all accounts, neither of them knew what was coming. Now, when Alec first talked to investigators about the night of his wife and son's deaths, he said he wasn't at the kennels that night at all. He said he had taken a nap at the house, then driven to visit his elderly mother, who had dementia, and then returned to find the bodies. When the first officer arrived on the scene, Alec was near the kennels. Interviewed by detectives, he sobbed as he described the scene he had stumbled upon and very quickly brought up the boat crash, the one with the pending hearing. He suggested Paul had been getting threats and was targeted by relentless online bullying. He was sure his wife and son's murders had something to do with Mallory Beach's death. Police looked into why Paul had been at the kennels that evening, and it turned out he was dog-sitting for a friend for whom he recorded a short video on his phone at 8:44 p.m. Apparently, something funky was going on with one of the dog's tails, and they were trying to chat about it, but the phone kept going in and out. Anyway, Paul managed to shoot a short video and send it to the buddy, who later forwarded it to police. In the background of that video, you can hear voices. Paul's, Maggie's, and Alec's. Witnesses who knew the family confirmed they recognized all 3 voices, and Alec didn't deny it either. The video placed Alec at the kennels that evening, within minutes of the deaths, the same kennels where he told police from the very first moment they arrived that he hadn't even been to that night. Pro tip, police don't like it when you lie to them about your whereabouts when they're investigating the murders of your family members. I mean, that was a red flag to them. But it wasn't the only one. Alec's clothes and hands were reportedly clean when they arrived to the scene, Investigators noted that detail because Alec had told them he tried to take pulses on both Paul and Maggie's bodies. And they had been shot multiple times. The scene involved significant blood and biological matter, yet none of that transferred to Alec. It took more than a year, but eventually, Alec was charged with 2 counts of murder. The indictment alleged that Alec shot Paul twice with a shotgun and shot Maggie 4 or 5 times with a rifle. And that's notable because it isn't that common that a single assailant kills with 2 different weapons. The crime scene, it should be said, was badly compromised. Evidence that arguably should have been collected wasn't. Alec went to trial in January 2023, and it lasted 6 long weeks, making it one of the longest in South Carolina history. And as you can imagine, it got the kind of media coverage usually reserved for presidential elections. Alec took the stand in his own defense. He admitted to the financial fraud, which he said was fueled by a decades-long and very expensive opioid addiction. He also admitted he had lied to investigators about being at the kennels. He said he lied simply because he panicked, because he knew how it would look. Plus, he worried, altruistically, that if police were looking at him as a suspect, their attention would be wrongly diverted away from finding the real killer. That is to say, they'd be looking at him. So, in short, he denied killing Maggie and Paul. The jury convicted him on all 4 counts in less than 3 hours. He was sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. And then the appeals began. More on that when we get back.
Some cases become known for changing laws. Others leave a mark because they force people to face hard truths. That search for answers can bring up a lot to process, whether the story is from centuries ago or the stress is happening today. Talkspace makes it easier to care for your mental health with a licensed therapist, psychiatrist, or nurse practitioner in your state. Choose live video, audio, or chat sessions that fit your schedule. Therapy is available every day, at any time, so support can become part of your routine. Plans are flexible, and providers can be changed at no extra cost. Thousands of licensed providers are available across all 50 states. Starting at $69 per week, help can fit your budget, and most insured members receive Talkspace for free. Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
Let's return to Becky Hill. Rebecca Hill was the Colton County Clerk of Court during Alec Murdoch's trial. As clerk, she was responsible for managing the jury, escorting them, overseeing their access to exhibits, helping the judge administer the proceedings. In other words, she was one of the people the system trusted most to ensure the trial was fair. Hill had known the Murdoch family for years. Her own family's history was entangled with theirs going back decades. In the book she quickly released after Murdoch's conviction, notes that relatives of hers were involved in a moonshine conspiracy in the 1950s in which the older Buster Murdoch, Alec's grandfather, was indicted and then acquitted. Now, you might be wondering how a solicitor, or a prosecutor, as it's called in the states I've covered, was indicted on such a charge. Well, that came courtesy of the feds. In 1956, Buster was indicted by a federal grand jury for allegedly warning a bootlegger to move a moonshine still into a neighboring county to avoid federal revenue agents. While he was acquitted, one report suggests the federal trial judge castigated Buster for his unethical practices. Now, Buster resigned his post after his indictment, but he was running for re-election unopposed, so he returned to office in 1957 anyway and held the post for another 3 decades. Anyway, Becky Hill had watched the Murdoch name operate in Colton County her entire life and had seen what it meant. And so, according to a juror who later provided a sworn affidavit, before Alec Murdoch took the stand to testify in his own defense, Becky Hill told the jury not to be fooled by him. She told them to watch him closely, to look at his actions and his movements. It was a short statement she made, but the juror later said she understood that to mean Alec would lie when he testified. The same juror later wrote in an affidavit that they had questions about Alec's guilt, but voted guilty because they felt pressured by other jurors. Hill's defense attorneys and Hill herself denied the jury tampering allegations. At a post-trial evidentiary hearing in January 2024, she testified that she didn't have conversations with any jury on any topic related to the case. The judge who presided over that hearing, retired South Carolina Chief Justice Jean Toll, found Hill not completely credible and said she had been lured by the quote-unquote siren call of celebrity, but Toll still denied the motion for a new trial, concluding that the comments had not influenced the verdict. On May 13, 2026, the South Carolina Supreme Court disagreed, unanimously. In language that was notably blunt for an appellate court, the justices called Hill's conduct breathtaking and disgraceful and unprecedented in South Carolina. They noted that Hill's position as an elected official, drawn from the same community as the jurors, gave her comments particular weight, that the jury pool came from the very people who had voted her into office. The court wrote, quote, "Hill placed her fingers on the scales of justice," end quote. There's more to the Hill story. As I mentioned, after the trial ended, she published a book called Behind the Doors of Justice, The Murdoch Murders. In it, she wrote about her experience managing the trial and her opinion of Alec's guilt, saying she was mostly concerned about Alec being found innocent when she knew in her heart he was guilty. What she didn't write was that she had shown sealed court exhibits, evidence the judge had ordered kept from public view, to members of the media, and then lied about it under oath when asked. She also was found to have plagiarized passages in her own book. Her co-author, who discovered the theft, publicly disavowed the book and publication ceased. Hill pleaded guilty in December 2025 to obstruction of justice, perjury, and two counts of misconduct in office. She was sentenced to 3 years of probation. At her sentencing, she said,
"There is no excuse for my mistakes. I am ashamed of them, and I will carry that shame with me for the rest of my life. I have already begun the hard work of rebuilding the relationships that I damaged by accepting responsibility, by seeking forgiveness from those that I love, and by repaying any improper bonus I received. I am committed to making amends."
But the Hill issue wasn't the only one flagged by the state's highest court. At the original trial, prosecutors spent 12 and a half hours over 10 days presenting evidence of Alec's financial crimes. Their argument was that the fraud established motive. Alec killed Maggie and Paul to buy time before a scheduled hearing that would have exposed his stealing. And to be clear, prosecutors don't have to establish motive in a murder case, but it does tend to help. And when you're asking 12 presumably reasonable people to find someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, it's easier for them to make the leap when they can wrap their heads around why someone might take the life of someone else, particularly someone they were supposed to have loved. To that end, lead prosecutor Creighton Waters, who'd been assigned to handle the case by the state attorney general's office, specifically because of the Murdoch family's close ties to the local solicitor's office, allowed witness after witness to spell out for the jury all of Alec's financial shenanigans. The trial judge, Clifton Newman, allowed it. Newman's been on the bench for more than a quarter century and is generally respected for his even temperament and fairness. In their ruling, the justices agreed that some financial crimes evidence was appropriate for the purpose of establishing motive, but they found the state went too long and too deep into details that had no bearing on why Alec might have killed his family. Now, to sort of hammer home the gist of their argument, a thought experiment, I intentionally structured this episode to start with the other bad things that have happened in Alec's life. I told you about his housekeeper and his financial crimes and the Stephen Smith case before I went into the murders Alec stood trial for. And by the time you heard about Maggie and Paul's deaths, do you think you were prejudiced against him? Or do you think that information was important context that you could fairly set aside if you were charged with finding him guilty or not guilty? Now, let's think about what supposedly happened with Becky Hill behind the scenes. If you heard about Alec being a crook, and you heard Becky Hill say, "Hey, don't be fooled by this guy," do you still think you could be fair? Granted, just before the jurors started deliberating, the judge gave his instructions that said, in essence, you need to set aside whatever personal feelings you have about this guy and focus on the evidence and the murders specifically. That's all you can weigh when rendering your verdict. The justices decided that wasn't really possible for jurors by the time they hit the deliberation phase. At oral argument earlier this year, one justice noted the financial fraud stuff, aka the motive argument, could have been made in an hour or two max. Another called the connection between the fraud and the murders debatable and not an easy connection. A third flagged specifically that testimony about Brian Harriet's disability, remember that's Gloria Satterfield's son, saying it served no purpose other than making Alec look like a despicable human being. And hey, no argument here. Now, the court didn't need to rule on any of this to order a new trial. The Hill tampering alone could have been enough. But the justices addressed it anyway, which basically sent a message to whoever prosecutes this case next time. The financial crime story should get significantly shorter. The next jury surely would hear a narrower version of who Alec Murdoch is. Whether that's enough to change the outcome is something nobody can answer yet. So that's where things stand. The Supreme Court reversed the post-trial judge's finding and ordered a new trial. Alec Murdoch, right now, is legally presumed an innocent man. Well, when it comes to murder, that is. It's not like this clears his name on everything, and rest assured, he's not coming home. He's still serving a 27-year state sentence and a 40-year federal sentence on the financial fraud convictions. But his family, not to mention the rest of the county and the country, are likely to see yet another circus of a trial. So a few things to end with. The Murdoch saga is easy to consume as a story about one man's spectacular fall, the scion of a dynasty who turned out to be a thief and possibly a killer, brought low by his own appetites. And that framing isn't wrong, but it leaves out the structural reality that Murdoch's thefts worked because the system around him was built to accommodate the Murdoch name. His clients trusted him because of who his family was. His law firm didn't scrutinize the account because of who his family was. When Gloria Satterfield died and no one looked, it was because of who employed her. When Stephen Smith was found dead and investigators hinted on tape at why the local sheriff's office wasn't touching the case, that was because of who lived in Hampton County. What made the Murdoch machine run for nearly a century wasn't just corruption. It was the accumulated weight of a name that had become synonymous with authority. Three generations of district attorneys, a law firm that engineered favorable court conditions, a community where, as one investigator put it, anytime anything happened, the Murdoch name comes up. Becky Hill knew all of that. She had lived in that world her whole life. And my interpretation of her very bad decisions is this. She was so certain, so absolutely certain, that the system would bend for Alec the way it had always bent for the Murdochs, that she may have convinced herself intervention was necessary. Never mind that the evidence was substantial. Never mind that the prosecution was competent. She had watched the Murdoch name operate in South Carolina courts for decades, and she had drawn her own conclusions about what justice needed from her. And worse, she quickly moved to write a book about it. But this is why you can't bend the rules or break the law, even if you think you're right. You have to play by the rules because your very intervention might be what ends up letting a guilty man go free. The Supreme Court ruling didn't say Alec Murdoch is innocent. It said he didn't get a fair trial, and even guilty people are entitled to those. Maggie Murdoch was 52 years old when she was killed. She was a mother and a wife and whatever else she was outside of those roles, which we don't know as well as we should because the coverage of this case has focused relentlessly on the man charged with her murder. Paul was 22, a kid who made a terrible, life-ending decision on a boat in 2019 that he was still facing consequences for when he died. Mallory Beach was 19 and is mostly a footnote in the Murdoch story, even though she died because a drunk 19-year-old wouldn't let anyone else drive the boat, and even though her family spent years fighting just to get a financial accounting of the man they held responsible. Gloria Satterfield worked for one family for 25 years. She died at their home. The cause of her death has never been definitively established. Her sons didn't learn they had been defrauded until 3 years after it happened. And last I read, her family gave state law enforcement permission to exhume her remains in 2022, and SLED said they planned to do it, but if any findings came from that, they haven't been made public. Stephen Smith wanted nothing more than to be a nurse. His mother has been waiting for answers for more than a decade. Whatever happens next in a South Carolina courtroom, and there will be more, these facts haven't changed. To research this case, I relied heavily on court documents, including the South Carolina Supreme Court's May 2026 opinion, which is worth reading in full if you enjoy watching justices use words like breathtaking and disgraceful in an official legal ruling. I read trial testimony and watched available video of proceedings, and I spent time in news archives pulling contemporaneous coverage from outlets including People, CBS News, and the Hampton County Guardian. I also leaned on the work of the 48 Hours team, whose public records requests on the Stephen Smith case produced details that local investigators apparently had no interest in surfacing themselves. For the Murdoch family dynasty history, I found Britannica and the South Carolina-based outlet Fitz News useful, the latter of which had dug into federal court records from Buster Murdoch's 1956 moonshine conspiracy trial that I would have otherwise missed entirely. A reminder, this has been a bonus episode I did on top of my regular weekly work for Crimes of the Centuries. If you like these episodes, send me an email and let me know they're worthwhile. I'm thinking I can handle maybe one every month or two. I'm tackling a current but less covered one for next month, suggested by a listener that I hope you find interesting. I engineer these by myself, so be kind. Music is by my dad and my child, so be extra kind, except when music's provided by Epidemic Sound. You can be mean to them if you want. No matter where you're listening, I am appreciative, but to directly support my work, you can subscribe to Grab Bag Collab at grabbagcollab.com or through Apple Podcasts. Until next time.